This program is sponsored by the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents with author Sir Max Hastings discussing his book, Vietnam, an Epic Tragedy, 1945 to 1975. I'm your host, Jay Williams, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. It's sponsored by the members of the museum and library. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. From the French attempts to reimpose colonial rule in Indochina after World War II, to the evacuation of United States personnel from Saigon in 1975, the conflict in Vietnam was one of the world's most divisive modern events. In his new book, author Sir Max Hastings characterizes the war overwhelmingly as a tragedy for the Vietnamese people, of whom 40 died for every American. Having spent the past 3 years interviewing scores of participants on both sides, as well as researching a multitude of American and Vietnamese documents and memoirs, Hastings relies on political, social, and military history to support his position that U.S. blunders and atrocities were matched by those committed by their enemies. With testimony from warlords and peasants, statesmen and soldiers, Hastings suggests that neither side deserve to emerge victorious from this polarizing and brutal struggle. Hastings also relies on his own personal memories to craft his narrative. These include reporting in 1967 and 68 from the United States, where he encountered many of the war's decision makers, including President Lyndon Johnson. He then had successive assignments in Indochina for newspapers and the BBC. Hastings himself rode a helicopter out of the U.S. Saigon Embassy compound during the final evacuation in 1975. Ultimately, Hastings presents a well-researched and challenging account of the conflict in Vietnam and brings to bear lessons about the misuse of military might to confront the intractable political and cultural challenges that continue to face us today. Sir Max Hastings is the author of 26 books, including the bestsellers All Hell Let Loose, Catastrophe, and The Secret War, and served as editor-in-chief of the Daily Telegraph and editor of the Evening Standard. He has won many prizes for journalism and his books, including Journalist of the Year, Reporter of the Year, and Editor of the Year at the British Press Awards. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the Royal Historical Society. In 2012, Hastings received the Pritzker Military Museum and Library Literature Award for Lifetime Achievement in Military Writing. Please join me in welcoming Sir Max Hastings back to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Good evening, everybody. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be back here at the Pritzker Library. You're always an absolutely wonderful audience, and I've had the pleasure and privilege of talking to this group before, and I know that it's one of the most discerning audiences about all things military in the United States, so how nice to be back with you. On the 28th of May, 1968, Michael Minahan, a 20-year-old Marine machine gunner in Vietnam, wrote to his folks at home, "Today, we are ninth day in the field. There isn't much to say because all we are doing is walking in the mountains looking for gooks. I thought I would drop you a line to say everything is fine." 5 days later, however, it stopped being fine. Minahan's parents in Marlborough, Massachusetts, received a telegram from Marine Corps Commandant, "Deeply regret to confirm that your son died on 2nd June. He sustained fragmentation wounds to the body from friendly airstrikes which fell short of the target area. His remains will be prepared, encased, and shipped at no expense to you, accompanied by an escort either to a funeral home or national cemetery selected by you. In addition, you will be reimbursed to an amount not to exceed $500 towards funeral and interment expenses. 16,899 such telegrams were received in homes across the land in 1968, over 300 a week. By the end of the war, in May 1975, 58,220 of Michael Minahan's compatriots had died, together with 18 Russians, 14 North Koreans, 771 Chinese, and more than 2 million Vietnamese, around 40 for every American corpse, together with numberless more Cambodian and Lao people. This bloodbath, in a succession of conflicts that lasted three decades, far exceeded the human cost of the 21st century's wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. Moreover, Vietnam made a cultural impact upon its times greater than any modern strife. During its last phase, especially, it roused the dismay and indeed revulsion of millions of Western people, destroying one US president and contributing to the downfall of a second. In the wave of protest against authority, which swept the West in the 1960s, rejection of old sexual morality and an enthusiasm for pot and LSD became conflated with lunges against capitalism and imperialism, of which Vietnam appeared an exceptionally ugly manifestation. Moreover, many older Americans who lacked sympathy for any of those causes came to oppose the war because they saw themselves systematically deceived by their own government about an enterprise doomed to fail. The 1975 fall of Saigon inflicted humiliation upon the planet's most powerful nation. Peasant revolutionaries had prevailed over Western will, wealth, and hardware. The stairway up which, on the evening of the 29th of April, fugitives ascended to a rooftop helicopter, secured a place among the symbolic images of that era. For me, as for all my generation of war correspondents, the struggle was among the foremost experiences of our careers. I was one of those who flew out of the US Embassy compound on that tumultuous, terrified day. And even before I first saw Vietnam, in January 1968, aged 22, I was among a group of foreign journalists who visited the White House. We were addressed by President Lyndon Johnson about his commitment to the war. That morning, his personality seemed no less formidable for being close to caricature. "Some of you like blondes, some of you like redheads, and some of you maybe don't like women at all," he declared in that deadweight drawl, gesticulating constantly to emphasize his points and making broad pencil strokes on a notepad in front of him. "I'm here to tell you what kind I like. I'm prepared to meet Ho Chi Minh anytime in a nice hotel with nice food, and we can sit down and talk to settle this thing." After making his pitch, this big man left the room abruptly without taking questions. We were preparing to leave when suddenly the president put his head around the door again. "Now, before you all go," he said, almost coyly, "I want to ask, do any of you feel any different from anything you'd read or heard about me before you came?" We were stunned into silence by this glimpse of the awesome vulnerability of this president of the United States at that moment of history. In those days, Vietnam represented in the world's consciousness prodigies of both natural beauty and man-made horror. My book emphasizes that the struggle was above all a disaster for the people of Indochina, on which an American tragedy was overlaid. I interviewed scores of Vietnamese men and women, communist and anti-communist, as well as US veterans. I read thousands of pages of translated memoirs and documents from both sides. Let me recount to you a minuscule wartime incident, such as was repeated 10,000 times. One morning in August 1964, Lieutenant Phan Nam of the South Vietnamese Airborne was leading his platoon in search of communist guerrillas. As they trudged through a ravaged village, he saw a young woman sitting silent on the brick floor of a wrecked house, holding a wicker basket. Her eyes looked straight ahead in a blank, stupefied stare. Nam asked why she lingered in the midst of a battlefield. She remained silent, her stunned eyes emitting a flash of terror. Suddenly, as if performing a gymnastic exercise, she thrust out the basket towards me. It contained two sets of clothes, a headscarf, two gold necklaces, and a pair of earrings. A soldier motioned the girl away, but Nam called her back, holding out the basket. Her hands trembled so violently that she was unable to take it, and instead, sobbing, began to unbutton her blouse. The young man was deeply embarrassed. She had read his rejection of her most valuable property as a sign that instead he wanted her body. What kind of life had she experienced that she would offer herself to a soldier who could be her younger brother, while tears ran down her terrified face? Nam persuaded the girl to follow his platoon to a nearby river crowded with sampans carrying fugitives from the fighting. People were calling out, among them a voice that screamed, "Lie! Lie!" This was an old woman who recognized Lieutenant Nam's traumatized acquaintance. The girl stopped, as if she was trying to summon up a memory from a past life. Then she cried, "Mother, mother, our house has burned down, our house is gone." The Southern officer described her walking away towards the water like a person in a trance. This is what wars, all so-called wars among the people, are like for people, and especially women, who are not fast jet pilots or green berets, but instead victims, whether in Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. Between 1945 and 75, such tiny tragedies were repeated countless times in Indochina. Foreign eyewitnesses concluded that most were the fault of first the French and then the Americans or their South Vietnamese clients unleashing devastating fire and air power. Yet a key theme of my own book is that blame seems rightfully to be shared with the communists, who committed numberless atrocities in pursuit of a revolution that wrought misery among their own people. Photographs exist which have become notorious of a South Vietnamese police chief shooting a captured Viet Cong during the 1968 Tet Offensive, of a screaming child fleeing naked after a 1972 South Vietnamese napalm strike, of the homes of peasants set afire by American soldiers. Yet the policy of omerta, silence, pursued by all communist regimes, well served that of Ho Chi Minh. No pictures were ever published of a Vietnamese being buried alive before his fellow villagers for the mere crime of being a small landlord. He pleaded for a merciful gunshot and was told contemptuously by his murderers that they saved their bullets for the imperialists. No photographer recorded the thousands of innocents killed in cold blood and buried in mass graves during the communist occupation of Hue during the 1968 Tet Offensive. Nobody in modern Vietnam, where tourists are so warmly welcomed, is permitted to speak of the thousands killed as class enemies during the first years of Ho Chi Minh's rule in the north. An American advisor, George Banville, described a typical episode during the later struggle in the south in which a Miss An, typist at a headquarters in the Mekong Delta, was seized during the night at her parents' home. Her head was beaten in with a rifle butt, her younger brother stabbed to death because she refused to assist an attack on the US compound. The officer wrote, "She was maybe 20 years old, a devout Christian, very pretty, very much a lady. My team used to sit on the porch in the morning and watch her stroll into work in a long, flowing Ao Dai with a matching umbrella protecting her alabaster skin from the sun. She ignored their stares, and you could only guess that maybe she disliked these foreign devils admiring her beauty, or maybe not." Likewise, advisor Mike Sutton described to me landing a helicopter in a hamlet where they found a limp figure hanging from ropes lashed to a tree, the village chief, disemboweled during the night. His wife had been less artistically murdered, their son castrated. Now, my own point is not to suggest that the US and the corrupt and incompetent Saigon regime which it supported were the heroes of the Vietnam Wars, merely that, as usual with all historical events, neither side commanded a monopoly of virtue or misconduct. We should pause before anointing the communists, the good guys, as did naive young Western protesters back in the 1960s. Many moralists would say, as I'm inclined to myself, that while Ho Chi Minh's people deserved their triumph over the French colonialists, neither side deserved victory in what came afterwards. Let me recap the chronology. The French colonized Vietnam in the 1880s, lost it to the Japanese in World War II, and then in 1945 embarked on an almost deranged attempt to regain control in the face of a vigorous communist nationalist movement led by Ho Chi Minh. When Mao Zedong secured stewardship of neighboring China in 1949, he threw support behind the so-called Viet Minh. The French suffered soaring losses and defeats until in November 1953, they launched an operation to lure the enemy into a battle on their terms by fortifying a chain of low hills called Dien Bien Phu. There, over the ensuing 5 months, they suffered catastrophe. Ho's military chief, General Giap, mobilized 60,000 peasant porters to manhandle two-ton artillery pieces 500 miles across some of the most terrible country in the world to ravage the French camp. The saga ended in surrender of survivors of the 12,000-man garrison to the raggedy communist army. At the ensuing Geneva Conference on Indochina, what was amazing was that the Russians and Chinese proposed a partition of Vietnam instead of insisting that following Ho's victory at Dien Bien Phu, the whole country should be surrendered to him. The explanation, ironic in the light of later events, was that following recent Western intervention in the Korean War, the communist powers were desperate to avoid an Asian replay. Beijing and Moscow tell the North Vietnamese, as we shall hereafter call them, to content themselves with half a loaf and wait for the South to fall into their hands when elections were held and the Americans lost interest. A hitherto unknown South Vietnamese, a Catholic anti-communist named Diem, was installed as ruler in Saigon, having ingratiated himself with the French and their puppet emperor, and more important, with influential American co-religionists, including Congressman John F. Kennedy. He took over in Saigon while Ho Chi Minh's Politburo assumed power in Hanoi. The communist regime implemented its ideology with conspicuous brutality. Privation, oppression, and sometimes starvation became the common lot of North Vietnamese, though their plight and occasional revolts were curtained from the world. Amid food rationing, there was a desperate search for taste treats, which included stewed rat with saffron, grilled rat with lemon leaves, locusts, grasshoppers, beetles, silkworm larvae. No pet was safe. I met a man who, as an 11-year-old boy, found himself moving home and hugging a cherished pooch that he had to leave behind. He told me some strangers took it away in the morning, and I understood that they were going to kill it. Dog was said to taste best if the flesh was beaten and softened before the animal was killed. In the relatively rich South, almost everybody had enough to eat, but the Diem regime persecuted its enemies, promoted Catholics in an overwhelmingly Buddhist country, and ruled with abysmal incompetence. Though both Vietnams became rival tyrannies, Ho Chi Minh's had advantages. He'd secured monopoly ownership of Vietnamese nationalism, heroic status as victor over the French. The cruelties and blunders of his regime were concealed from the world by ironclad censorship. The war slowly started up again in the South with so-called Viet Cong taking the place of the Viet Minh. The new guerrillas reflected peasant hostility to the Diem regime and spontaneous activism by southern communists, rather than being driven by Hanoi or even Beijing, as Washington deluded itself. Only in 1962 did the North Vietnamese, now led by the implacable Lê Duẩn, rather than the aging Ho Chi Minh, began to provide serious backing. In 1964, the US decided that unless it dramatically boosted military aid, the South was doomed to collapse, which President Johnson believed would be unacceptable to the American people. The following year, he began dispatching major combat units on a scale which climaxed in 1968-69 with 500,000 troops, waging a struggle against mostly regular communist formations dispatched from the North. Each month, US forces unleashed an average of 128,000 tons of munitions. The culture shock was huge for young Americans meeting Asia for the first time. Private Reg Edwards' first surprise had nothing to do with death and devastation, but instead with finding that even tiny children smoked, which seemed to him horrible. The first Vietnamese words I learned to say were, "Cigarettes are bad for your health." In the boondocks, many men were nervous of snakes, disconcerted by the gibbons shrieking in the trees. They loathed the ubiquitous leeches. The Johnson administration also embarked on an air campaign against North Vietnam, which hurt its own cause far more than that of the communists. The bombing united Ho Chi Minh's people, as the earlier unification struggle had not, rather in the fashion that the Nazi Blitz had brought together the British in 1940. There was so little industry in the North that air attack made small impact. And although completely contrary to Western perceptions, the Russians and Chinese were reluctant to lavish resources on the struggle and had little control over the Hanoi Politburo, in the face of US bombing, Moscow dispatched flak guns and SAM-2 missiles, which shot down almost 1,000 US aircraft. In the eyes of foreigners, the war-making of a giant, symbolized by the B-52 bomber, which killed tens of thousands of Vietnamese, seemed repellent, contrasted with the courage of communist soldiers wearing coolie hats and tar rubber sandals, their women digging trenches and repairing bomb damage. In Hanoi, in December 1966, Premier Pham Van Dong inquired urbanely of New York Times journalist Harrison Salisbury, "And how long do you Americans want to fight, Mr. Salisbury? 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We shall be glad to accommodate you." As for the men doing the fighting, infantryman John Del Vecchio wrote, "For many soldiers, Vietnam was depression, despair, a valley of terror. Much of the anxiety came not from the enemy, not from the jungle. It came from being taken away from wives and friends and family and being totally out of control. Many firefights were brief. In one that lasted just 30 seconds, 15 of 35 patrolling Marines were killed or wounded. Often, a handful of VC used their weapons for only a minute or two and then pulled out before artillery could work on them. Amid incoming, the great Tim O'Brien wrote of the stiff thump of the bullet like a fist, the way it knocks the air out of you and makes you cough, how the sound of the gunshot arrives about 10 years later, and the dizzy feeling, the smell of yourself, the things you think about and say and do right afterward, the way your eyes focus on a tiny white pebble or blade of grass, and how you start thinking, oh man, that's the last thing I'll ever see, that pebble, that blade of grass, which makes you want to cry. There were booby traps, booby traps, booby traps, what the 21st century calls IEDs, and how they hated them all. Most were manufactured from scavenged US ordnance. A 60mm mortar round removed a foot, while an 81 took off a leg and maybe some fingers and an elbow. A 105mm round would take both legs and often an arm. A 155 vaporized its immediate victim below the waist and almost certainly killed anybody else within 20 yards. Grunts engaged in macabre debates about which limb they'd soonest lose. Most claimed a preference for keeping knees and what was above them. In 1 3-month period, a single company lost 57 legs to mines and booby traps, which, as an officer bleakly observed, amounted to almost a leg a day. Among some terrible deeds, virtuous ones deserve emphasis. Texan Shirley Purcell was a veteran nurse summoned to active duty in 1966. She took a passionate pride in her work. "I really didn't have a political commitment, but there were American troops there that needed help." She was thinking, for instance, of an infantryman who triggered a Bouncing Betty mine. This young man had literally been ripped in half from his knees up and from just below his ribs down. It was like hamburger meat. All of the internal organs were just chopped up, but his legs were perfect laying on the litter, and his hands, arms, upper chest were perfect, and his mind was still very much alert. He was looking up at us, and the sense that went over that entire unit with that young man lying in the emergency room dying because there was absolutely nothing we could do for him was like nothing I've ever experienced. He looked up at me and said, "Well, how's it look?" I had to tell him, "It doesn't look good, but you won't be alone." And that was really all we had to offer, that he would not be alone. Shirley had been a teetotaler all her life, but in the officers' club at Tulai, she started on screwdrivers, and who could blame her? Later, she could never bring herself to watch MASH on TV because her memories imposed a veto on laughter. Could the US involvement have had a different outcome? Many Americans who went to Vietnam were inspired by high ideals of service. One of them, a fine officer named Colonel Sid Berry, wrote home in 1966, "I would be nowhere else. I'm convinced of the rightness and importance of our being here. I've come to have great respect and affection for the Vietnamese. They do surprisingly well under circumstances more difficult than our country has ever imagined. But a long road lies ahead. I hope that our country and our countrymen have the maturity, stamina, patience, guts, faith to stay in the fight as long as is necessary." A colleague recalled the words of legendary MANIC advisor, Colonel John Paul Vann, who devoted most of the last decade of his life to the war. John said that we had assisted the Vietnamese to rise high in the sky in a heavier-than-air machine and must help them come down as gently as possible rather than crash. Asked what the difference would be, he said, "There are more survivors that way." The two men once landed a tiny chopper at an outpost that had been overrun during the night. They crammed into the cockpit a badly wounded South Vietnamese soldier and then headed past for a hospital, yet the man died in the air. And when they landed, Vann stood banging his fist furiously on the cockpit plexiglass, saying again and again, "Just another 20 minutes, just another 20 minutes, and he would have made it. His companion thought, "This is a guy whom John never met in his life, yet he cared terribly about him because he was on our side." The anecdote is moving, and yet the American commitment was fatally flawed by its foundation not on the perceived interests of the Vietnamese people, but instead on the perceived requirements of US domestic and foreign policy. An American prisoner, Doug Ramsey, who spent an unspeakable 7 years in the jungle, in the hands of Viet Cong, in a bamboo cage, once described to me how he told his communist interrogators that he thought his compatriots' presence in their country was prompted 10% by concern for the Vietnamese and the rest by determination to check Mao Zedong. His puzzled captors demanded, "In that case, why do you not go and fight him in China? We do not like the Chinese either." The decisions for escalation by successive US administrations command the bewilderment of posterity because key players recognize the rickety, rackety character and the regime on which they depended to provide an indigenous facade for an American armored edifice. Yet great states, unsurprisingly, like to fight the kind of war that suits their means rather than the one they've got. America's leaders deluded themselves that all the social, cultural difficulties identified above could be overcome by an overwhelming application of firepower, as if by using a flamethrower to weed a flower border. Since this was the core policy failure, it seems to me wrong to lay extravagant blame upon America's generals, unimpressive though some of them were. David Elliott, a wise civilian who spent years in Vietnam for RAND, said to me, "There never was a clever way to fight the war." General Jim Gavin, the World War II paratroop hero, was among those who warned at the start, "If a village is fought over five or six times, a great many civilians will die. The whole pattern of life will be altered. As the war continues to drag on, we ourselves destroy the objective for which we fight." Even before considering the consequences of bombs and shells, Washington's decision makers failed to recognize the cultural impact of a foreign host upon an Asian peasant society. A local secretary earned more working for the Americans than did a South Vietnamese colonel. Bulldozers and airfields, armored vehicles, watchtowers, sandbags, concertina wire ravaged the environment even before guns began to fire, helicopters to swirl overhead, huge soldiers to purchase the sexual favors of tiny women. This was not a curse unique to Vietnam, but in the 21st century overhangs all Western interventions in far-flung places, however well-intentioned. The communists enjoyed the critical propaganda advantage that they were almost invisible to most of the people most of the time. They set up a light footprint on the land, contrasted with that of the foreign power. 4 million tons of American bombs fell on the South. To this day, Western military commanders fail to understand the folly of sending their soldiers to wage wars among the people wearing sunglasses, helmets, and body armor that give them the appearance of robots empowered to kill, impossible to love, or even to recognize as fellow human beings. In both North and South, wherever the communists writ round, they propagated terror and confiscated personal freedom. For all the adulation heaped by the Western left upon Ho Chi Minh and Lê Duẩn, they presided over a fundamentally inhumane totalitarian regime. Yet its mandate seemed more credible than that of the Saigon generals. While few Vietnamese had much interest in Marxist-Leninist theory, many were seduced by the promise of a revolution that would cast off the yoke of landlords and moneylenders, expel foreigners. A southerner said to me, "The communists could ceaselessly remind us how humiliating it was to be occupied by the Americans. The other side had the monopoly of patriotism." A key lesson from Vietnam for the West 21st century struggles in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, is that it's very hard to exploit mere battlefield successes to build sustainable societies. That fine American officer, H.R. McMaster, once described to me his successes commanding an armored cav regiment in 2004 Iraq. He concluded sadly, "The problem was there was nothing to join up to." Former Saigon correspondent Neil Sheehan says, "In South Vietnam too, there never was anything to join up to. In the absence of credible local governance, winning firefights was and always will be meaningless." Yet if the war couldn't have been won on the battlefield, the US might have contrived to inflict less damage through the excesses of its armed forces on its stature as a standard bearer for civilized values. It's a common illusion that beneath fatigues, young Westerners, including the British, fighting abroad, remain decent hometown boys. Some do, others don't. Soldiers are trained to kill. Circumstances of combat oblige them to live a semi-animal existence. Many warriors come to hold cheap the lives of bystanders, people they don't know, especially when their own casualties are high. In Vietnam, soldiers were often baffled by rules of engagement designed to curb civilian casualties. One protested to journalist Michael Herr, "That's what a war it's getting to be. I mean, if we can't shoot these people, what are we doing here?" It's hard to fine-tune the conduct of half-educated young men in possession of lethal weapons who are, like most soldiers most of the time, hot or cold, filthy, hungry, suffering constipation or diarrhea, thirsty, lonely, weary, ignorant, holding their nerves and rifles on hair triggers, because only thus can they hope to survive. Soviet and Nazi precedent suggests that merciless occupiers can suppress resistance by force. In Vietnam, the US Army contrived to be sufficiently intrusive and racially contemptuous, also intermittently murderous, to earn the hostility of the population, but not cruel enough to deter many peasants from supporting the communists. Excesses, while not universal, were sufficiently common to show that many Americans considered Asians inferior beings, their lives worth less than those of round eyes. It was a terrible symbolic mistake, I believe, to enlist Vietnamese, to shine the humblest PFC's boots, and to sweep his quarters. In the later stages of the US commitment from 1969 to 73, guerrilla warfare gave way to conventional clashes between large forces in which it's possible that the US Army might have defeated the communists had not the will of the American people and the commitment of many of its soldiers already been broken. Even had firepower prevailed, however, it's hard to envisage to what good end. The Saigon regime commanded negligible popular support. There was still nothing to join up to. When a South Vietnamese officer discussed his country's 100-odd generals with comrades, they concluded that around 20 were competent and honest, while 10 were both monstrously corrupt and irredeemably incompetent. In the midst of a discussion with the Americans about how the morale of Saigon troops might be improved, one South Vietnamese general's contribution was to propose reintroducing the French army system of mobile field brothels. Arguably, the people of Vietnam had to experience the communist model, as they did at dreadful cost after the North Vietnamese achieved final victory in 1975 before they could reject it. The war cost the United States $150 billion, much less than Iraq two generations later. Yet the true price was paid not in money, nor even in lost American lives, but instead in the national trauma that it inflicted. The American people's belief, both in their moral rectitude and military invincibility, created by the outcome of World War II, matched by an economic success so awesome that it seemed only logical to believe that it reflected the will of a higher being, was sorely injured. General Walt Boomer says, "The Vietnam War did more to change this country than anything in our recent history. It created a suspicion and mistrust we've never been able to redeem." Walt Boomer says that the great lesson he himself carried home from Vietnam was tell the truth. I myself argue that the overarching mistake made by America's political and military leaders was less to lie to their people about Vietnam than to lie to themselves. Major Don Hudson, who commanded an infantry company in 1970, said of the disillusionment of US veterans, "They thought they were going home with their uniforms on and their little medals and everybody would be really happy to see them. And they found out that was not true." Another veteran, Corpsman David Rogers, is among many who still looks back with profound emotion. He told me, "The experience was huge. I had a lot of trouble coming home and going to church. I couldn't confess. I felt dirty. I'd been part of killing." The only memory that matters to Rogers, like hundreds of thousands of his former comrades, is that of his own platoon. To be able to say that as a corpsman, I was there for them. Around one third of his people were killed or wounded. Living close to Washington, he sometimes visits its memorial wall at 5, 6 in the morning. I won't go when there are others around. To me, it's a big headstone. I'm glad I have it. I have about 10 names. Tony from Chicago, Jerry Johnson from Minnesota, Sam and some more. Moments come back. Seeing a tree line up at Martha's Vineyard, I thought, that's like Vietnam. The prettiest sights I saw there were choppers over tree lines. Reading writers like Neil Sheehan, I get so angry with them, the people who ran America. They knew what was happening. We didn't. I did the pace count, and that was it. In 1993, David Rogers returned to Vietnam as a guest of its government and was taken to the area where his own unit had fought. He found himself feted by former Viet Cong, who were under orders to embrace Americans because they needed Congress to pass a trade deal. Rogers found himself reflecting, if all these guys wanted was a McDonald's, surely we could have worked this out a long time ago. Modern Western tourists are disarmed by the warmth of the welcome they receive in Vietnam from people mostly unborn when the war was fought. This is partly because an overwhelming majority, privately at least, now recognize the virtues of liberal democracy and the shortcomings of the alternative. President Obama received a rapturous reception when he visited Vietnam in 2015, contrasted with the extraordinarily frosty one given a year later to China's President Xi. Visitors impressed by the glitzy towers of Saigon, the natural beauty of the countryside, often fail to notice the harsh rural poverty and absolute denial of freedom of speech. The rulers of 21st century Vietnam concede to their people some latitude to make money, but none to express political opinions, frankly, to debate the past. I write much in my book about the American so-called credibility gap during the war years. Yet in Hanoi, mendacity remains institutionalized. A conspicuous lesson of the past century is that economic forces are at least as important as military ones in determining outcomes. North Vietnam's dead revolutionaries would recoil in disgust from modern Saigon. The name Ho Chi Minh City is falling from favor and will probably eventually vanish in the way that Leningrad has become St. Petersburg again. Its glittering shops, temples of consumerism, burst with brand names, jewelry, and designer clothes. I would argue that while the US lost the war militarily almost half a century ago, it has since seen its economic and cultural influence reverse that outcome. Where America's armed forces failed with B-52s, defoliants, and spooky gunships, YouTube and Johnny Depp have proved irresistible. Trung San was a 13-year-old boy wrestling playfully with a friend on a hillside in North Vietnam on the day in 1975 when his village loudspeakers announced triumphantly that Saigon had been liberated. He wrote long afterwards, in a book entitled The Winning Side. According to what we had been taught at school, this would be the end of 2 decades of misery for South Vietnam. I thought we must quickly set about educating its misguided children. Yet in 2012, that same boy observed, many people who have carefully reviewed the past are stunned when they realize that it feels like the side that was really liberated was the North. South Vietnam, he argues, has proved historic victor because its values increasingly dominate the country. As for Americans, Walt Boomer muses, what was it all about? It bothers me that we didn't learn a lot. If we had, we would not have invaded Iraq. Thank you all very much.
Did the subsequent wars after Vietnam that Viet Vietnam engaged in Cambodia and then later China. Did that have an influence on the warming up to the U.S. culturally and economically?
I felt that I hadn't tried to write about Cambodia and Laos in this book because it's already probably about as long as anybody can take. But I did spend quite a bit of time in Cambodia and Laos myself. I think one mistake, some American historians, I think, adopt what I would call an almost flagellatory approach to writing about the war, in that, for example, they regard the destruction of Cambodia as entirely America's doing. Once again, I would say that all blame must be shared with the communists, because in the end, the reason that the Americans got into Cambodia and Laos was because the communists were using it as an arterial, estuarial routes into South Vietnam to run the war. So it was a huge tragedy, but it was also, it was the North Vietnamese who created the Khmer Rouge in the South. And while I would not defend, I think it was a huge tragedy, the secret bombing of Cambodia in 1970, and thereafter, Operation Menu, which was largely Henry Kissinger's creation. I do think, again, one has to see this. The Americans would not have got involved in Cambodia and Laos, whatever misjudgments they made once they did get involved, if the communists hadn't been using it as supply routes. But it was that these were colossal national tragedies.
Thank you. When I was a boy, they taught us of the domino theory.
Yeah.
The domino theory seemed to be false, especially after Sukarno was overthrown.
There are still some people today that some Americans quote Lee Kuan Yew, the Prime Minister of Singapore for many years, who often told the Americans that he didn't believe that the rest of Southeast Asia could have been stabilized had not the Americans fought in Vietnam through all those years, which enabled many Southeast Asian and Asian governments to achieve a degree of stability that they hadn't got before. I'm not quite sure I totally go along with this. What is for sure is that the original domino theory did not turn out in that way, in that the idea that just because one country goes down, that the neighbor has got to go down. But one of the things I try to do as a historian is, again, I think a big mistake made by some historians, they see everything in terms of a 21st century prism. I try to close my eyes and think, how did things look at that time? And again, while I think that the United States completely misjudged the situation in Vietnam, there was a genuine, very serious global communist threat. I've written a whole book about the Korean War, and I'm absolutely convinced that the United States and its allies, including Britain, were absolutely right to intervene in Korea. And South Korea today is a model for democracy and capitalism, whereas North Korea is a model for the alternative. But I think the biggest tragedy, the one lesson I feel I've learned from writing this book and other books, is that in so many of these situations, the big things are the social and cultural and political things. There's a military dimension, but you can't see them in purely military terms. And I think the big mistake in the United States was in the era of McCarthyism, a lot of people were kicked out of the State Department, a lot of people were kicked, who knew a lot about Asia and about Southeast Asia. And to leave the whole thing to soldiers, even today in Iraq and Afghanistan, of course you've got to have soldiers there and you've got to have generals there, but I would never put a general in total command because there are so many more dimensions than this. And again throughout the whole 50s and 60s process, that it was seen as an overwhelmingly military problem when it wasn't. And the domino theory, yes, Eisenhower wrote to, in 1954, to Winston Churchill, who was still in his last days as British Prime Minister, begging him to accept that the validity of the domino theory, that if we don't resist these people in Indochina, they're going to take over everywhere. And I've got some sympathy because, yes, there was a genuine global communist threat, but it's an awful shame they didn't understand the nuances, the cultural nuances and so on of Indochina much better. For a start, the fact that the Vietnamese are traditional enemies of the Chinese. And the one thing which I didn't understand when I started writing this book, and it's absolutely fascinating, far from the Vietnamese being the cat's paws of the Chinese and of the Russians. In many ways, the Russians and the Chinese, they felt obliged to help these revolutionaries, and they felt obliged to support them against the United States, but they hated the whole business. Brezhnev, when he was running Russia, told the Soviet ambassador in Washington, "I have no wish to drown in the swamps of Vietnam." This is a Russian leader speaking. Nobody understood that at the time. To the very end, you've got Kissinger and Nixon in the White House believing that if the Russians pick up the telephone to Moscow, that the whole war can be ended. It wasn't like that at all. So that's another dimension. Our intelligence about these places was terrible. It was terrible in the 1950s, terrible in the 1960s. I'm not really persuaded that our intelligence in Iraq and in Afghanistan is that much better today.
Why didn't the United States ever look for a non-communist nationalist leader in the 1950s and 1960s that could have really led Vietnam in a different direction?
I think one has to put a lot of the blame on the French, that if the French had ever tried to promote a serious non-communist political class, then you might have had some people there who were able to stand. But the worst problem was that Ho Chi Minh secured monopoly ownership of Vietnamese nationalism by defeating the French. And when Diem took power in Saigon, virtually everybody whom Diem appointed to significant positions had worked for the French colonialists. And one thing they'd certainly not done was work for the revolution and for the struggle against the French. And if you wanted, the one thing that all the Vietnamese people, communist and anti-communist, agreed about in the late 40s and early 50s, they wanted the French out. And the people who got the French out were heroes. And so you were on the wrong foot after 54 if you didn't have impeccable credentials as a fighter against the French. And virtually nobody around Diem did. But it was a great misfortune. If you'd wanted to have a non-communist Vietnam, you had to start way, way back promoting non-communist politicians.
How would you apply your experience of Vietnam to the evolving situation between the U.S. Trump administration and China?
I'm not sure that there's a direct parallel there. I will tell you one story which actually is not related to Vietnam, but about, as far as the Chinese now, about 5 years ago, there was a group of Chinese generals visiting Britain. And I was one of those who was asked to speak to them. And they'd been told that I'd then just published a book about 1914 and the beginning of World War I. And one of these Chinese generals asked me, he said, "Do you see any parallels between 1914 and today?" And I said, "Yes, I do see one. That to me, the great irony is that in 1914, Germany was become overwhelmingly the most successful economic and industrial power in Europe. And that if the Kaiser had not gone to war in 1914, nothing could have prevented them from 20 years from becoming the most dominant power in Europe." And I say, I can't help looking today at China's quite extraordinary economic and industrial achievement and thinking, is it worth putting all this at risk for whatever's going on out there in the South China Sea? And one of the generals said, "But we have claims." And I said, "Well, I might even have a bit of sympathy with some of those claims, but that's not the point. The point is it really worth putting all this at risk?" But I don't see a parallel. I don't think you can relate, or I can't, off the top of my hat, relate Vietnam to the Chinese situation. But I do think the danger of miscalculation, I do think there are other historic parallels, because the Chinese are playing a game in the South China Sea which is incredibly dangerous and seems out of all proportion to anything they're going to gain from down there.
Do you think that there could have been a different outcome had the U.S. not had restrictive air campaign early in the war?
No, I don't believe that. The airmen did go through phases of saying, if only we'd taken the gloves off, we could have made a success of this. I don't buy into that. I've written acres of my book about this, and I'm afraid airmen throughout the last 100 years have persistently overstated what air power can achieve, and they certainly did that in Vietnam. When you've got a situation, one of the statistics, and I'm doing this from memory, so I may be slightly off. In the mid-60s, they figured out that the communists in the South were fighting the war on a daily ration of about 350 tons of supplies. But of that 350 tons of supplies, 90% was generated locally down the south, and only 10% had to get down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And I don't think there's any evidence that that if there'd been more intensive bombing in the north, that it would actually have done much to the capability of the North Vietnamese. That I'm a chronic skeptic about air power. I think the lesson of the last 100 years is that air power is devastatingly effective tactically against troops in the open, and especially against armored vehicles in the open. But once you get it against complex industrial installations or against dug-in troops, it becomes much more iffy. And in fact, this guy who became one of my heroes while I was writing the book, Doug Ramsey, who probably an American who knew as much as any American about Vietnam and spent whatever it was, 10 or 11 years there, 7 years as a prisoner. But Doug said that when he heard that LeMay, the Air Force Chief of Staff, had talked about bombing Vietnam back into the Stone Age, he said, "I wanted to get out of my cage and get back and tell him, you can't bomb a nation back into the Stone Age that has never left it."
Just as a side note, I flew helicopter missions behind B-52 strikes in Vietnam, and I can attest to the fact that they were essentially ineffective, no matter how much bomb was dropped onto the jungle. Can you comment on the French negotiations, so to speak, with the U.S. for support from the 47 to 51? And when you talked about not being myopic about this war and only looking at the war itself, but look in the context, did that context affect decision?
You're raising a very important issue, which I've written a lot about in the book, that one of the amazing things is the United States spent the whole of the Second World War telling the European powers, considerably the irritation of Winston Churchill, that when the war was over, they got to get out of their empires. Which was, on the whole, a reasonably sensible view, although Churchill was sometimes inclined to suggest to Roosevelt that as long as there was segregation, racial segregation in the US, he wasn't in too much of a hurry to take it all. But anyway, the US was broadly right that the gig was up for empires. But then the Cold War gets going, and the French have started this absolutely insane campaign to try and hang on to Indochina. And I may say, one of the things I didn't know until I wrote this book, they also, 1945, the French suppressed a revolt in Algeria in which they killed 25,000 people. In 1948, they suppressed another revolt in Madagascar in which they're estimated to have killed 90,000 people. And none of this the world even noticed. And I went to some trouble to research and check those figures. So that's the background against which Indochina was going on. And most sensible people realized by about 1950 that the French had no hope of winning. And even the French were starting to realize that. But then the Cold War gets going, and a lot of people in Washington decide that the anti-communist cause is also the cause of the French in Vietnam. And so by 52, the Americans are paying for every bomb and shell that the French are unleashing in Vietnam. The French are fighting, wearing American helmets, using American weapons, driving American jeeps. And it's not too surprising that when American troops turned up 10 years later, that most of the Vietnamese thought this was the son of the colonialists coming along. And the fact it was one of the huge American foreign policy errors to convince themselves that it was a good thing to get into bed with the French, who were A, going to be losers, and B, on the whole, deserved to be losers. But I put it all in the book, but I mean the weight of stuff the United States sent the French, and this was a big, big mistake.
Hi, thank you. And I've read over 300 declassified CIA documents begging us not to get involved in the war that were all ignored. I still believe the only reason the war ended was because Mao Zedong said he would not meet with the United States unless we made an agreement to leave Vietnam. Now, I look at the war is going on now in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Syria, etc. There is almost no press coverage. And the anti-war movement, much like the anti-nuclear war movement, ended during the Obama administration in order to support those wars. Do you think personally that we need an anti-war movement now?
I'll say those wars are
not going anywhere.
I will risk saying something provocative. I try always, as a guest in your great country, to be very careful what I say about contemporary politics. But I will tell you a story that I was talking to some Oxford students a month or two ago, and I always like to wind them up a bit. And I said, your fathers and your grandparents were out there demonstrating for the campaign for nuclear disarmament in the 50s and 60s. And I said, some of us thought they were incredibly naive, but at least they were demonstrating about something terribly important. And I said, one thing I find baffling today is that all you guys seem able to get excited about is gender. And while I know that gender is terribly important, but I think you touched on something very important that Henry Kissinger said the other day, and although I've been very critical of Kissinger in my book, the first, unquestionably, he's a brilliant man and a great man. Maybe some, you know, it's not the ones under illusions about his cynicism. But Kissinger was asked the other day by a student audience whether the world today was a more dangerous place than the 60s. And he said, absolutely, it most certainly is, because we've lost. The great thing is not stability is the key word, and what we're seeing out of the window all over the world is stability. So the world is a very dangerous place, and I think, my own opinion, I think the kids would be much better employed being out there on the streets demonstrating about some of the really big stuff that's going on, that I think you've hit something very important. They just don't seem to notice some of this terrible stuff that's going on. Anyway, I don't want to go too far down this route at the risk of, you know. One more? Yeah.
Well, you actually presupposed my question about Henry Kissinger. He had a lot to do with promoting the Vietnam War. He also orchestrated an overthrow of the Chilean Democratic Government in 1973. And there was a British humanist, atheist, forgotten his name, the writer who died of cancer, you know, the famous man, Hitchens, who toured the United States with a program to declare Henry Kissinger a war criminal.
No, I don't believe in that sort of
thing. You don't believe in that.
What you can say, and what I've said in the book, the most recent declassified White House tapes, which were only released in 2015, and which I've made extensive use of, Kissinger and Nixon's conversations in the White House in the last phase of the war, to me, are awe-inspiringly cynical, in that from the moment that Nixon became president in 69, they never kidded themselves for a second that the war was winnable. They were determined to get out. But everything they did was directed towards trying to convince the American people that they had not suffered a defeat or a humiliation. And 22,000 Americans died and countless more Vietnamese, while Kissinger and Nixon are, if I'm not being too cynical, to say we're playing a very elaborate political game. And to me, one of the most devastating exchanges on these White House tapes was October 72, a month before Nixon faces McGovern in the presidential re-election campaign. Kissinger comes back from secret talks in Paris with the North Vietnamese, and he rushes into the Oval Office and he says, "Mr. President, we have got a deal better than anything you could ever have dreamed of." And he doesn't then say, "This is going to bring peace, this is going to save countless lives." He says, "This will absolutely, totally screw McGovern." And the cynicism of these people. And what, of course, is amazing is that what you can say, as a historian I can say, that through the ages, heads of state and their advisors have had equally cynical conversations about events. But, of course, now that it's all on tape, you can't run away from this stuff. And I like to think I'm fairly well-versed in the stuff that goes on in high places. But reading the transcripts of those White House tapes, boy, I mean, these two were something else again. Anyway, thank you so much. Thanks, it was a very nice audience.
Thank you to Sir Max Hastings for an outstanding discussion, and to the members of the museum and library for sponsoring this program. The book is Vietnam, An Epic Tragedy, 1945 to 1975, published by HarperCollins. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you for watching, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at pritzkermilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the Museum and Library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.